You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
September 4th, 1957 should have been the first day of school for a group of black students at a newly desegregated high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, but white protesters and National Guard troops prevented them from entering the building, and a photographer was on hand to capture the racial tension raging that morning. One image, published in newspapers around the world, shows a white girl screaming a racial epithet at a black girl, an image that seemed to encapsulate the debate over desegregating public schools. In his latest book, Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock, David Margolick discusses the iconic photo and the relationship between the two women involved. It's published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Margolick back to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you, Leonard.
You set Little Rock's racial tone by telling the story of a black man named John Carter who was brutally murdered there in 1927. Why begin with something that happened 30 years earlier?
Well, I thought that it was important to capture the kind of spirit of Little Rock and the kind of mixed historical record that it had, so that I juxtaposed the last lynching in Little Rock in 1927, which was a horrific event. I mean, even as lynchings go, just an absolutely awful, awful event, with the construction of the new high school, which went up the same year. And I thought that it was absolutely striking that these two things were happening at the same time and that they captured the kind of schizophrenia of Little Rock, that on the one hand it was a southern city with redneck attitudes, and on the other hand it thought of itself as more progressive, and it was building a high school for the ages, Central High School. And I was struck by that juxtaposition.
You write, in 1957, there wasn't a single establishment where a white man could have a cup of coffee with a black man in Little Rock, and police intervention would be required if a white man were to sit next to a black woman, even if it was in a colored establishment.
Yeah, this was based on the visit of a fellow named Harold Isaacs, a professor at MIT, who went to Little Rock in 1957 to sort of scope the place out and find. He was writing about how the embarrassing things that were going on in race relations in America were affecting American foreign policy. And so he went around and interviewed some of the burghers of Little Rock. He was a Jew. He couldn't have belonged to the Little Rock Club where he was interviewing people. And he described very graphically just how racially divided it was. And it's interesting because Little Rock thought of itself as enlightened. And Little Rock was always saying, you know, we're not Mississippi. Arkansas is not Mississippi. So it was no coincidence that, in a way, Little Rock took upon itself the role of desegregating the first major high school in the South. It thought of itself as more progressive.
Because the Supreme Court had given southern states a lot of leeway. They said that they should desegregate with all deliberate speed.
Right, very ambiguous.
And some places saw that as a chance to drag their feet for quite a while.
Right.
Well, there were two high schools in Little Rock at the time, one for blacks, one for whites. Were the schools very different?
I think the black high school was a very prestigious place, and blacks from all over Arkansas would come and go there. It was a Rosenwald school, one of the few Rosenwald schools that was built in a big city.
It's called Dunbar High School?
Well, it was originally Dunbar High School. By the time Elizabeth Eckford, the black girl in the picture, was in high school, it was Horace Mann. They had moved to another school. But, of course, it was a pale imitation of Central High School, which was the most prestigious school in the state. And, you know, everything about it was inferior. The textbooks were inferior. The facilities were inferior. Everything about it was smaller, more diminutive, more beat up. You know, they got the hand-me-down textbooks from Central High School. So for a black person of ambition would want to go to Central High School, and that's why Elizabeth Eckford applied to go there.
Although officials called Dunbar High the most modern and complete public high school building in the United States erected specifically for Negroes.
Yes, that was, I think, in the WPA guide or something from the 1940s, and that probably was true.
So what was the process for selecting the black students who would attend Central High?
It was very haphazard. I mean, the principal criterion was to have as few of them as possible. And it was done rather accidentally. The superintendent of schools interviewed the various candidates. There were about 70 or 80 black students who lived within the district who were eligible to go.
But I'd imagine quite a few would many have been reluctant for obvious reasons.
Yes, many of them opted out, and then the superintendent winnowed out the rest of them. It was very clear that he didn't want any activists, he didn't want any troublemakers, he wanted people who would turn the other cheek and put up with all of the abuse that they were likely to get. He wanted Jackie Robinson types. You know, the name Jackie Robinson kept coming up, somebody who could put up with the abuse and not fight back. But it was all done.
But maintain his dignity.
But maintain his dignity. And the fact that Elizabeth was chosen out of all of these people is really a testament to how accidental it all was, because her makeup was rather fragile, and anybody who'd been paying a lot of attention might have had qualms about letting her in, as intelligent as she was.
Looking at the photograph, which is on the cover of your book, we see Elizabeth in the forefront, and then behind her we see Hazel. And just by the look on Hazel's face, we can tell that she's screaming something rather horrifying.
Right.
We don't even have to hear it.
Right.
Do we know what she actually said?
Yes. And, I never know what the rules are on NPR. But, you can bleep it out. She was saying, nigger, go home. Mm-hmm. Nigger, go back to Africa. You have your own school. Things like that.
We do have the photograph on our show page here at WNYC. But at the same time, Elizabeth looks like she's just ignoring it or walking right through,
walking
trying
very
to be as
stoically
dignified as possible.
Yes, walking very stoically. Her eyes are hidden behind her sunglasses. I think that, she was very shaky and very scared and determined. By the time the picture was taken, she had tried three different ways to get into the school. Three different times she'd approached the troops. They'd blocked her way and even locked bayonets in front of her. So they threw her back into the crowd on the street, and she's now walking to the bus stop, where she thinks that she'll find sort of an island of tranquility and the bus will take her away from there.
But there were other students who were supposed to attend the same day. How come they weren't all together?
Because Elizabeth's family didn't have a telephone, and so Daisy Bates, who the NAACP official who was in charge of organizing them all, never reached Elizabeth and forgot to call her in the morning. So Elizabeth was the first to show up, and showed up by herself, and so she suddenly found herself in the middle of this mob.
And the National Guard troops had been brought out by Governor Faubus?
Had been brought out by Governor Faubus and were ringing the school. And yet somehow the message hadn't gotten through to Elizabeth that they were there to keep her out. She didn't realize that.
And she thought they were going to protect her.
She thought that they were going to protect her. And so she was shocked to be turned away. And she was very much by herself. And then she finds herself in the middle of this crowd with Hazel and other people screaming behind her. Hazel's story is interesting because Hazel was not a rabble-rouser. And this is one of the great paradoxes of the story that, she was a 15-year-old girl. First of all, she looks a lot older than that in the picture. And history has judged her much more harshly because she looks so much older than 15. And she was really kind of a ham, an actress type, somebody who liked to perform. She wasn't particularly politically attuned. She wasn't following what was going on much. She knew that the blacks were going to integrate the school and that her family didn't approve of it. But she didn't go to school there that morning with the idea of protesting. She just sort of fell in with her friends.
And she was, you say that the only thing that really separated her from Elizabeth was race. They came from similar kinds of family backgrounds?
Yeah, it's interesting that when you see their houses, and Elizabeth still lives in the same house from which she went to school that morning after 55 years. She's still there. Even architecturally, their houses are very similar. They're little tiny Monopoly houses. They were built after the war for returning GIs. Their worlds were very similar in every respect but race. Their incomes were the same. Hazel's father was a disabled veteran. Elizabeth's father worked for the railroad. They were both Democratic families. They'd both voted for Faubus. They had a lot in common, everything but race.
Will Counts is the photographer who took the picture, and he seemed to be in the perfect position. Were there other photographers? I'm assuming there were, because this was seen as a historic day.
Yes, there were several other photographers there. And in fact, in the book, I include pictures by two other photographers taken almost at precisely the same instant from slightly different angles. And you can tell that they're a little bit askew only because Hazel's mouth is more open in some than in others. But they're very similar pictures. And I'm glad you mentioned Will, because in another interview I neglected to mention him and somebody got very angry. I mean, he was the man that took this immortal picture. He was 26 years old. This was his first big assignment. He was working for the Arkansas Democrat, which was the segregationist paper in town. So it's odd that they were the ones to get this picture. And he had gone to Central High School. He graduated only a few years earlier.
How long after the incident did the black students have to wait to gain access to the school?
Well, this picture was taken on September 4th, which was the second day of school, actually. The blacks didn't show up the first day. And the blacks finally got in temporarily on September 23rd, so it was 19 days afterwards. But they were essentially run out of the school. The protesters were threatening to come in and essentially lynch them, to drag them out of the school. And the school officials panicked, hid them in the back seats of various station wagons, and smuggled them back out of the school. And it was only the next day Eisenhower sent in the paratroopers. And that's what changed everything. And so on September 25th, 3 weeks after the picture was taken, Central High School was finally desegregated.
And life must have been terrible for these kids, at least for a year or so.
Life needn't have been terrible if you think about it. I mean, if the school had enforced the rules and monitored the situation more closely, they would have. I mean, life was going to be bad no matter what, but it didn't have to be as bad as it was. As it was, the school officials essentially abdicated their responsibilities and left the school in the control of 200 hoodlums who terrorized these black students all year long with very few repercussions. And so as traumatic as the day that the photograph was taken for Elizabeth, the following year was much worse. And, you know, she was scalded in the shower. She was thrown down the stairs. And she and all of the black students were, you know, had their lockers ripped through, suffered one kind of indignity after another.
Were people in Little Rock aware of the impact the photograph was having outside of the South? It was rallying whites who were concerned about the South's racial problems. And it was even being used by the Soviet Union as a kind of a propaganda.
Right. I think that the people of Little Rock knew that the picture had made them the picture and the entire episode had made them notorious all over the world. I mean, there's a story in the book about a performance of South Pacific on Long Island where Nellie Forbush, the nurse in South Pacific,
who's a racist in the play,
right,
initially,
says, you know, I'm just a little hick from Little Rock, and the audience started to boo. And they had to stop the show for a couple of minutes. But it was very clear that, you know, the Russians were making great hay of this. And Sputnik goes up at the same time that all of this is going on. And the Russians actually announce the precise moment when Sputnik can be seen from Little Rock. You know, we're the future. You're the retrograde and racist and intolerant past. And if you want to see the future, just look up in the sky.
The cover also has photographs of the women later in their lives, and that's a major part of this story, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I didn't want to – one could have just written about the picture and the moment, but in fact, the way that their lives unfolded is a very important part of the story. It really is the entire second half of the book, and they've been bound by this picture ever since and haunted by this picture ever since and had – one would think that they would have gone their separate ways, but in fact their lives have been completely intertwined in the last 55 years.
Hazel sought out Elizabeth?
Hazel sought out Elizabeth in 1962, which is really quite extraordinary. She called her up.
5 years later.
5 years later. Hazel had a couple of children by then. Hazel had never graduated from high school, had dropped out of Central High School, in fact, because of the notoriety of the picture, and ended up going to a very small school closer to her home. Married early, had a couple of kids, was watching the awful scenes out of the South of the fire hoses and the German shepherds in Birmingham, and realized that she had made her own distinct contribution to the ugliness of desegregation in the South, and that she had two little kids to whom she would have to explain one day that she was the girl with the ugly face in the picture. And so on her own, without talking to her husband and without talking to her minister, she picked up the phone. She was living in a trailer outside of Little Rock, and she looked up Eckford in the phone book and called up. It was a very short conversation. She spoke to Elizabeth. She said, "I'm the girl in the picture, and I just want you to know how sorry I am." And I always stress that, you know, there were no cameras rolling when she did it. It wasn't one of these Oprah-like moments where everybody was watching. She did it in the privacy of her own life and soul and home. And for many years, no one knew that she ever did it. And she's always fought the idea that she's remained the girl in that picture, and that somebody with that ugly a face could never evolve. And in fact, you know, she dedicated much of her life to sort of ameliorating race relations. She started studying Black history. She worked in the Black community.
She also became a belly dancer and got involved with spiritual healing.
Yeah, well, she's an interesting woman, and she's a self-taught woman, and she just was adventurous, and she went off in a lot of different directions.
Now, what about Elizabeth? She had planned on becoming a lawyer. That's the reason she wanted to go to a better high school. What kind of career did she wind up with?
Well, this is, you know, it's enough to make you weep. It's such a sad story. I mean, this is not a sugar-coated story that I tell. Elizabeth had a predisposition to depression even before all of this happened, and then it was exacerbated by PTSD as a result of her experiences. So she initially tried to go to college, and after considerable difficulty got a college degree, went into the Army for 5 years, but was really out of commission for many, many years, for decades. She had two children by men she never married. She was on disability for many years and didn't work. And really only in the late 90s did she come out of this prolonged funk and depression and life of poverty and start to rebound, in part, you know, with the help of medication. And she took a job as a probation officer and sort of rebuilt her life. It's very inspiring.
And that's when actually she met, the two women met each other. The 40th anniversary of the picture gave them a chance to meet each other for the first time since
that's
that
right.
morning.
That's right. And Hazel had wanted for 35 of those years to meet Elizabeth. And the original photographer, the guy that took the original picture, Will Counts, had the idea of bringing them together. And that's where I come into the story, because the picture was taken of these two grown women smiling with one another in front of the high school. And when I went to Little Rock to do a story about Bill Clinton, it was turned into a poster. I mean, all of Little Rock was celebrating the apparent reconciliation of these two women. It meant in a way that Little Rock had, you know, it represented, they hoped, how far Little Rock had come in the intervening years. And so I instantly recognized that if they had come together, there was a story behind that. And I had never read that story. So that's the story that I set out to do.
Although they've never become buddies.
Well, the interesting thing is that after when I talked to them, they had already known one another for 2 years. And they had become buddies. They had become quite intimate with one another. They as different as they are, they share a lot. I mean, they're both kind of loners in a way. They're both interested in similar things in history and flowers. And they went on field trips together. They spoke to civic groups together. They spoke to schools together. And they spent a lot of time confiding in each other. But there were sort of a schism started to develop between the two of them by the time I met them. They hid it well the day that I was there. But Elizabeth is a very skeptical and discerning and persnickety woman in a way. And she thought that Hazel had not come fully clean with her story, and that there were holes in what Hazel was saying, and was treating Hazel sort of peremptorily when they got together. And Hazel, in the meantime, was finding that blacks and whites alike resented what she had done by coming forward to apologize. And so there was this disillusionment setting in, and the two of them, shortly after I saw them, the two of them stopped talking to one another.
I guess race relations still remain a problem in this country.
Still remain a problem, but the two of them are profoundly bonded to one another, and there are signs since the book came out that they're coming together again, maybe. They're corresponding, and I'm hoping the last chapter hasn't been written in their relationship.
David Margolick's book, Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock, is published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us,
Leonard. Again, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.